The Beer EDU Podcast, Episode 118, Grading and Assessment with David Frangiosa. Welcome to the Beer EDU Podcast, the podcast for educators that love to learn and share ideas with fellow educators over beers, with your hosts, Kyle Anderson and Ben Dixon.
Kyle, what's up?
Going on, Ben?
Not much. It's been a bit, and well, we're back with another episode, episode 118.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, we took a little bit of time off for the holidays, and for the most part, it was an enjoyable experience for me. How about you?
That was good. It was good. It was, you know, did a trip, saw my kid, came back from school, and yeah, it was all good. It was all good. I think I'm out of practice. I guess I should start with introductions. I am Ben Dixon. You can find me at BDixonNV on Twitter, Instagram, and I actually posted a blog. So you can find me on Rummages and Ramblings. It's on WordPress. So you, my friend?
I am Kyle Anderson. Completely surprised that you kicked out a blog. So now I
know.
I have to go and read
it. Dropped that bomb right there.
Yeah, that nice. Way to surprise me on that one. But you can find me on Twitter at Anderson EdTech, and then the same thing with Instagram, and then my blog, which I have not posted in a little bit, AndersonEdTech.net. I am the author of To the Edge, Successes and Failures Through Risk-Taking. You can learn more about that at ToTheEdgeEDU.com, and that's on Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com, through my publisher, EduMatch Publishing. My writing took a little side street for a minute because you and I were actually working on chapters for a book. I don't want to get into details about that. We'll just leave it at that. But you and I had that going on.
Yes, I would say that was my procrastination at its finest. Don't give me a year and then tell me it's due this, because I will literally wait. I got it done before the due date.
Yeah, I got mine done 4 days before the due date myself.
You were ahead of me, because I may have looked and I was like, how far behind am I on? And then I was like, oh crap, Kyle's already done his. I better get going.
Yeah, that's the beauty of that. We were working on a Google Doc and you could see the other 18 authors on there too. So that was pretty fun. So, yeah. But now, I mean, we took some time off and I drank a buttload of beer over break. A lot of good ones. But I actually took a break from beer for a couple of weeks because I drank so much over break. So, but I want to hear about your beer first, because this is a good one that I need to find now.
I agree. I was the same. I took a little trip as part of my break, went to one of my favorite places, San Diego. And of course, you know, had some great beers, some great stone beers and that stuff. But this is a Firestone Walker, and I just found this one like at my local grocery store. You know, a couple of weeks ago. It is called their Cali Squeeze Blood Orange Hefeweizen. And I'm not a huge Hefeweizen fan, but I just wanted something kind of light. It's 5.4% ABV, 15 IBUs. And I mean, all I can say is really it's a refreshing, easy drinking, Hefeweizen. It's not super overpowering.
Would this be a lawnmower beer when the snow's not flying?
Yeah, it could be. It could be. I mean, it's kind of, I have it in a can right now, but I mean, it's got a little bit of kick. It's kind of sour. So it's got that nice soury orange kind of taste in it. So yeah, it's definitely one when it's warm, you know? Yeah. So, I did find, and I posted it on our, I think I posted it on our Instagram. I went to the store and I found, I've already done this beer and I was going to do it tonight, but I wanted to do a different one. I found, for whatever reason, my grocery store was clearance, the Ninkasi Slayer winter beer. It was on clearance. My wife goes, why don't you just buy all of it? Which I was like, oh yes, I will buy all of it. I bought eight six packs.
Twist my arm, sweetheart. Twist my arm.
$4. I'm like, what's wrong with you people? So, I mean, That maybe I'll feature later, but I've already done that one.
No, that's a good one. I haven't had that one in a couple of years now.
It's one of my faves. So you, my friend, have something. I'm curious about yours.
Yes. So I think I mentioned this on a previous episode that I got the beer advent calendar for the month of December. And as excited as I was for it, it's a lot harder to commit to drinking a tall boy every day for 24 straight days. So I ended up falling behind on it. And I think this is the one that is supposed to be December 18th. So I'm about six beers behind, and here we are. We're already halfway through January, but that's okay. So this comes from Brauerei Schwanitzer. I totally butchered the German on that, but it's their Rauchbier. And we've done this before. Like we did a learn about this. Rauchbier literally translates to smoked beer. Yep. So it is just a standard German lager, but they smoke the malt. So like you get this smokiness to it. So it's light, it's clean, it's got that little bit of smoke flavor to it. Unlike you purchasing 8 six-packs of Slayer, I would not sit here and try to crush a six-pack of this stuff. Because I mean, it's good, but like, I mean...
one tall can, that's a drink.
Yeah, I mean, after a while, I think it'd be like drinking an ashtray or something like that, which just would not be very good. But no, I mean, it's good. It's a nice change of scenery because it's not a style of beer you see real often. And actually, when I checked into it on Untappd, I got a new badge for Wheel of Styles. I had never had an actual Rauch beer. I've had a smoked beer, beers that have been smoked before. I've never had an actual German Rauch beer, so I actually got a badge for the Rauch beer style in the Untappd app. So I thought that was kind of cool. But so this one's 4.8% ABV, 30 IBU. Yeah, I mean, like I said, it's good, but no, we're not. We're definitely not crushing six packs of this.
Yeah, I would have to look to see if I can find I know that I've seen the advent calendar ones, but I've never seen that particular. We have a great new German restaurant here in town, so I'll have to go look to see if they have it.
Yeah, so, the German restaurant here, well, Hofbräuhaus, which you've been to the one in actual Munich.
And I've been to that one, too. So, yes, I've been there.
But they always have just your standard German lager. They'll have usually a Hef. They'll have a Dunkel. Mm-hmm. They'll have the Oktoberfest usually around that time of year. I've never seen them do the Rauch beer, which that one, it's really niche. I mean, they're... The beers they typically have are ones for the masses that most people are going to drink. So.
For sure. But, Kyle, we would be remiss. We also have a guest, and he has beers to talk about.
We do. And so coming at us from New Jersey today is David Frangiosa. So we were just talking before we got on that we were probably going to butcher names because, you know, six different pronunciations for Italian names sometimes. So. So we went with one of them, we think. So, David, did we get that?
Nailed it.
Nice.
Oh, there we go. He wouldn't, I have to have the feeling that you would just say that anyways.
No, he got it. He nailed it.
So Dave, you had some beers you wanted to talk about. Share with us, like, what's your, we talked about one of, like, an all-time classic before we were recording, but tell us.
So in one of the previous episode, you'd mentioned the 90 minute, the Dogfish had 90 minute, and that's one of my favorites, but they, once a year, they come out with the 120 minute, which is outstanding. If you see it, you got to grab it, but my all-time favorite brewery is a brewery out of Cooperstown called Omegang. And they have the Three Philosophers, which is a triple. It's just so smooth. It's a really good beer. Yeah, everything from them. I haven't had one bad beer from them, though.
Kyle, you said you've had their beers.
Yeah, for a while, they were kicking out this bottle series that was devoted to Game of Thrones.
Okay.
And there was various ones that they kicked out, and they were the big bomber bottles with the cork in them and everything. They were real nice. And I can't remember the name of it now, but there was a double stout, imperial stout that they made that it was aged in bourbon barrels. And then they also added star anise to the batch. So you had this bourbon taste, but then you had this slight hint of like, well, anise has a black licorice flavor, but I don't want to go as far as saying that's really what it was, because then it sounds like you're drinking a beer that tastes like Jaeger and Jack Daniels or something like that, which that's an unfair comparison to it. But and I'm not a huge fan of black licorice, but man, that beer was incredible. And it was so good. And I was getting it at Costco for a while. They had the Bombers at Costco out here, but that was a few years ago now. Wow. I haven't seen any Omegang since then, but I've always wanted to go to Cooperstown because obvious reasons, Baseball Hall of Fame's there. So I got to get there someday. But now I got to get there because of Ama Gang as well.
Well, and that brewery is pretty cool because they do festivals there and people actually like camp out for the weekend. And, you know, so it's an event. Like, it's definitely a place I'd check out.
That sounds a little bit like the brewery that does our absolute favorite Pliny there, Ben. They do the camp outs and everything too. So,
oh, yeah.
Russian River.
Yes. I know, and now I'm looking at Ama Gang because the first beer that they have that you pull up on Untappd is Three Philosophers.
Yeah.
And that's like a, that is like a, that gets, that's got some serious high rankings on Untappd. So that is definitely one.
It's a good one.
It says it's at my big box liquor store in town. So now I have a task. I have a task this weekend. I'm going to go see if I can find it.
Well, David, not only are you a beer lover, but you are also an educator like Ben and I. So introduce yourself. Tell us a little bit about where you are, what you do. Kind of give us the David Franjosa story here.
Sure. So I am a high school science teacher in northeastern New Jersey. We're about, 15 miles outside of New York City. I've been teaching. This is my 16th year. Teach all different sciences and Kyle, like you, I deal with a lot of our special ed population. So I am not special ed certified, but that's something that I've been doing my whole career. So, I saw some kind of, I guess, challenges with teaching the special ed community and the way that we've traditionally done things, which kind of led me to trying some different things out with grading. And, you know, I co-authored a book, Going Gradeless, and that's all about like that journey. I blog, I podcast, so just kind of trying to spread the message of like, we don't have to do things the way we've always done them. And that's kind of me in a nutshell.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm super interested in the grading thing because that is something that as a district, my district is looking at specifically at high school. And so kind of, I mean, there's so many things we can talk about. I mean, we were joking before, we could all talk about the elephant in the room that is COVID-19, but I feel like Kyle said it best. He goes, it's like Groundhog Day. We just keep doing this. So I am interested though in kind of what led you on your journey to focus on grading. Cause really, truly, I feel, and this is my opinion, that that's like almost the third rail in education. Because like, if you start messing with grading, especially in high school, people flip out because for all kinds of reasons.
Yeah. Like, initially, yeah, definitely there are strong reactions. And look, admittedly, when I started teaching, this is my second profession. I was actually a chiropractor before I went into teaching. And so like I had no teacher prep. I knew a lot of content. I knew a lot of science, but like relaying that to students, I was pretty bad. And I made a lot of excuses for it. Like I started off in a charter school and I don't have the resources, I don't have a curriculum, whatever it was, there was always a justification for why I wasn't doing as well as I should have and why my students weren't, progressing the way that they probably could have. And, it wasn't until my third district where I was like, wait a second, I'm seeing the same thing in three very different demographics. With three very different levels of support. And, in my third district, like it's an affluent district and I have all the resources that I could ever possibly want. And I'm still seeing these same challenges. And, as like everything I tried didn't work until I touched that third rail and said, you know what? It's grading. Like every conversation I have, it comes back to like, what do I need to do to get this? I was just like, yeah, don't worry about that. That'll come. We have to focus on right now your problem solving. You're not actually reading the problem and understanding what it's asking and every time I tried to have those conversations, students would be like, yeah, but what do I need to do? And I was like, I'm telling you, right? Like these are the things that you need to do. And just that constant circular conversation going back to the grade, I just got so frustrated. And it really wasn't you know, it wasn't to benefit the student. It was to, for my own sanity, I was just like, I can't have this conversation anymore. Like, we're just going to get rid of it. And it wasn't that simple. I talked to my supervisor, admin, all the way up. I got it cleared. But like, it was really a selfish genesis. But once I started down this path and you start seeing like how grades really impact motivation, self-esteem, you know, and learning, you can't unsee it. And, you know, it's ignited me ever since. And this is year six, you know, of doing this, and I've learned something new every year. I don't do things the same way. It's the same basic framework, but you know, the one thing that I really did well was I asked the students what's working for them, and they really helped shape this into what it is today.
Did you find that the students that were the quote unquote high achievers, or I'm not sure if you taught AP classes, was that conversation more common with them? The whole, what do I need to do to get this?
So, I don't teach the AP classes. And frankly, I don't want to. I have some issues with the whole College Board AP system. You know, I'm not a fan of that, but, my goal as an educator was to really make an impact. And I said, those kids will learn in spite of me. So I gravitated more towards the kids that I felt like I could make a bigger difference. So, you'd be surprised. Yes. AP honors, like they're very grade focused. My co-author, she taught AP and she was having these same conversations. And we actually run the same system for all the physics classes that we teach. So we did it from AP all the way down to the inclusion, you know, every level that we taught. And she was having similar conversations, seeing similar obstacles. Her motivations were a little different than mine. And like, we detail that in the book, like, you know, what my motivations were, what hers were for getting rid of the grades. But yeah, you'd be surprised at, now the students that I was dealing with, they might not necessarily say, I want an A. They're saying, what can I do to get a C? What can I do to get a B? What can I do to pass the class? You know, like whatever they were comfortable with, but it's still that same conversation. It's just at a different level, right? The learning wasn't center. It was just like, you know, what boxes do I have to check? What hoops do I have to jump through? What can I give you that will, you know, help you give me what I want? It was just a really transactional relationship that I wasn't enjoying teaching.
Yeah, I asked that question because when I taught AP a few years ago, that's what it was like. Those were the conversations you had. Well, what do I have to do in order to get an A? Or the big issue I had was we had, no lie, like six different levels of a high school diploma you could earn. You could get a basic one. You could get an advanced diploma. You could get a college and career readiness diploma. You could get I forget what else there were. But there was all these different levels. And many of the kids were just, they were flat out open about, I want to get this graduation, this diploma here, and I need these classes to do this, and I have to have this high of a GPA to do it. So what do I have to do to get to that? And it wasn't about the fact that at the end of the year, they could take that AP exam and possibly earn college credit. It was frustrating because they would put in the work in order to do well on assignments and then for the most part assessments. But when it came time for the AP exam, a lot of them didn't care, especially because my school paid for their test. So there was no, you're on the hook for the $120 or whatever it is for the test. So then when the results would come in come summertime and I see out of 50 kids, like 80% of them get on a 2 or lower. And that was so frustrating. But at the same time though, I don't want to make excuses, but that's kind of what I was working with though. It was kids that were more interested in like, what can you do for me now and get me to this advanced diploma kind of deal versus seeing the bigger picture. Yeah. And that was really frustrating.
Oh, go ahead, Ben.
So I just was going to add, I mean, kids are smart. They're like, what is the minimum that I have to do? Like if it's not, it becomes like, what's the score I need that's really it. It's not about the learning. It's not about, you know, and not every kid's going to be super into science or super into like calculus or anything, but it just becomes it's like, I'm going to learn this and then I'm going to move on. Cause that's all I need.
Yeah. And you know what, those students do need that floor. They need to know what is the bare minimum. And for us, the way that we did it, we have minimum course requirements. So, you know, we evaluate labs, you know, problem solving projects. Like, so there's certain things that are easier for me as a science teacher to evaluate with a hands-on lab and a lab write-up. Other things, like through what is kind of like a traditional test, like our questions are very different and the way we approach it is very different, but like it's that kind of format. And then projects. And so we have minimums of how many of each students need to do in order for me to have enough information to really understand where they're at in their learning journey. So like, and we kind of set it up so there's enough practice where we can give them feedback. They can try it again. I can give them more feedback, and it's just that continuous cycle. So they do have that bare minimum, but now it's not about a score. It's about, okay, I did this much practice. I got this much feedback. I responded to it this many times, you know? So it's constantly engaging in that cycle of trying, revising, trying again.
And that, I think that's so good, because I think we as adults, we talk about this all the time. And even in my level, at an elementary level, we talk about like in life as an adult, but we always use the driver's test as an example. You can have as many times as you want to take the driver's test. So why can't you revise your work once you get feedback from people? So I guess, Dave, I would wonder, like, when you first started this, like, did you get a lot of pushback from parents, from kids, from other staff?
Yeah. So there were a lot of, I guess confused would be the best word to use. Like, why am I doing this? And I teach juniors in high school. Why are you doing this in their most important junior year? They're getting ready to apply to college. And like, I knew that was coming. So before I ever did this, before we switched, and I switched mid-year, I had parent information nights. So I said, this is what's coming starting second semester. Here are two nights. You can come in. I'll answer any questions you have. And, you know, I stood in front of the firing line. I let them, you know, voice their opinion. I let them ask every question that they had. You know, we were there for probably about an hour and a half a night. And, you know, I said, look, I'm not telling you I have all the answers. This is why I'm doing it. What I'm doing is not working. To continue doing this isn't in the best interest of your child. So here's how I propose that I change it. And I promise, if I see something that's not working, I'm going to honor the intent of this shift and we're going to make it right. And like after that meeting, there were parents who might not have agreed with me, but they trusted me, you know? So, and there were still a few that, in that first year or two that were really hung up on the grade. But now I haven't had a negative parent interaction in years. You know, the students and some of my most vocal opponents of it when I first shifted, by the end of that, that first semester where I did this, they're just like, you know what? I didn't think I was going to like it, but you know, I learned a lot that made a whole lot of sense. And, you know, I enjoyed your class more the second half of the year than the first, you know? And so as flawed as my initial rollout was, I saw enough positives that I was just like, all right, there's something to this that we got to just keep going. And Elise, who's the co-author, we shared a room and she was teaching AP. I was teaching, you know, collaborative. And she's like, what did you do to your students? They're like totally different kids. And I just told her what I was doing and she's just like, I want to try it. And so the next year she kind of hopped on board and we did similar, but like just parallel versions of this. And we compared notes the whole time. And then we kind of came together and said, okay, this worked for me. That worked for you. And we just kind of started trying what was working for each other. And over the years, just kind of refined it. As far as pushback from colleagues, I wouldn't say there was pushback. There's some snickering, you know, like, you know, what are you going to do now? Like every year is changing something and they're just like, you know, oh, what's he up to this time? You know, the opening meetings, what are you changing this year? What are you reinventing? And yeah, like me, I really don't care what people think of me. So I just kind of like let that roll off. And, you know, my students were liking it and that's all I really cared about. And, you know, my administrators, they saw the benefit to it and they've been so supportive the entire time. You know, I went with, my director of curriculum, my principal now, who was the assistant principal at the time, and a couple other teachers. We went out to Chicago and visited a couple of schools who were doing standards-based grading. And that's kind of how I started with standards-based grading. They sent me up to Connecticut to visit a school, Windsor Locks, who was shifting over completely. And, you know, so they really gave me a lot of great experiences that helped shape my ideas and, you know, kind of take the good pieces from everything that I've seen, plus my observations, and just kind of put together something that works pretty well.
So if somebody is wanting to do something like this, where's the starting point with this? So, and I know it's going to be different for everybody, but what's a good starting place for somebody that's interested?
So that's a great question. And for me, I wouldn't suggest anybody do things the way that I did it to start. You know, it was, you know, I'm glad I did because I got a lot of great information, but like, if this is something you're considering, go through an entire year with this in mind, right? What are the things that you're trying to assess? You know, what are the outcomes, that you want for your students, right? What are you looking for them to know and be able to do? And then how are you assessing that? What information are you getting? Is that does that information really give you a clear picture of where that student currently is in their learning journey and what their next steps are? And, you know, just start looking at everything you're doing. What can you use? What do you have to modify? And just, you know, once you have that map of the entire curriculum, then you start trying to put language to it. And that's like your summer work before you start that next year. So I would suggest this whole process take one full year. And, you know, like we tried to lay out in the book, because like it's something that I wish I had as I was going through this, like, what's my first step? And first step is just understand your why. Like, what do you value, right? If you don't know what you value, like, what are we doing? You know? And so we go through the steps that we took to find what we valued. And then how did we flesh that out? How did we build language around that that communicates to students that, all right, here's what we value and here's how you can get there. Like putting a standard, you know, whatever it is, like, you know, 1.3A-2, like that means nothing to a student, right? So how do you communicate that in language where they can say, okay, I get what I have to do. I get what you're looking for. And, you know, we try and use strengths perspective, like, you know, eliminate all deficit thinking, because like it's tough, especially for students who haven't met with success often in school, to just be told constantly, here's everything you're not doing well. It's like, you know, so I approach kids now with, all right, great. Here's what you're doing, right? This is great. Here's something you can add to make it better. So where are the opportunities that you have in your curriculum where you can engage students like that, right? Where are the opportunities for goal setting and supporting the goal setting? And, you know, what are some of the things that you're doing really well that students are responding to that you can expand on? And that's really where I would start.
I really appreciate what you said about the standards and making them to where students can actually understand them. So I have started to see with various schools and even states, some states are starting to do this where the standards are no longer, like you said, the 1.3.7-A4, blah, 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 where it may still have that number or whatever, because that's just the system they use for naming the standards. But instead of it being this convoluted, long statement about what the student needs to learn about X topic or whatever it may be. It's an I can statement. Mm-hmm. I can do this. By the end of this unit, I can do this. I can do that. And it makes it a lot easier to understand. I appreciate you pointing that out. And I appreciate those schools in the states that are starting to shift that too, because it's hard for teachers sometimes. I read some of those documents that are put out by states as to what standards are. And I'm like, wait, what am I even supposed to begin to teach here? I don't even know.
Well, and the big thing is like, so that's, it's all this educational jargon. What does that look like? Mm-hmm. How can I show a student can actually perform that standard? So I think, yeah, David, that's a great point, is to having them like reframe that discussion.
And that's the hardest part. Like getting that learning language is the hardest part. And, you know, so right now the framework of what we do is pretty set. Like it works well, but we're still tweaking language because, you know, it has to be a cycle. You put language that you think students will understand. They have to generate, you know, some kind of product. And then you see, does this match what I envisioned when I wrote this language? Right. And then you adjust from there. If it's not, like, it has to be an ongoing conversation with the students. Say, hey, how come, like, this is what I was looking for. What, how'd you interpret this? And like, you know, so you work on your prompts, you work on like, you know, that learning language. And, you know, so yeah, that's the tricky part.
Well, and I don't know, cause you teach science and there's a number of science standards. I don't know if you can address this, but maybe in your work, you've come across this. One of the things that we talk about is there is a, especially in elementary, like you look at the ELA standards for a grade, there are so many, and I know this is a bad word and whatever, but I think there are certain ones that you have to know. We talk about this, like, what do your kids got to know when they leave your grade level to be successful in the next grade? The other stuff, it's good to know. It is important to know, but is it the most essential? So do you guys ever have that discussion about like we're just going to really try to focus on these?
Yeah. So that was probably the first 3 years of development, is having that discussion of what's important, because, you know, science, we have a ton of content. I teach physics.
Okay. Right.
Right? Oh, so, yeah. You know, like we did, actually, let me backtrack. So when we first started, content was important. I started with 60 I can statements. Right. And, you know, my mindset was, all right, I want to be explicit. This is everything that, you know, my most important things. It came out to like 60 things. And I had this generic rubric about how well they did each thing, how independent they were. And what I found, there was a lot of redundancy, right? And so I was like, well, if this is rated this way here, it has to be rated that way there. And there became a point where it was very subjective, because, you know, what does independence mean? Right. You know, what's a little bit of help, you know? So like we call them mushy words, right? So like when we had those like mushy words where it's just like, well, yeah, you can interpret that different than I can. And like, we tried to move away from that, but like we always valued content and said, so we had content standards. And what we saw was, at the beginning and developing levels, it was all about just knowing the terms, the basic definitions, and then just kind of understanding some basic things about it. And then when you got to proficient, it was application or above, and, you know, kind of following that Bloom's taxonomy, a progression of thought. Not that one's higher level or lower level, it's a progression, right? And so you have to know certain things in order to be able to apply them. And so we said, wait a second, if we're seeing this, we have to separate content from skill. And so we have the science practices. And when you look at the science practices, they're not unique to science, right? You talk about ELA, we argue scientific claims, and we have a format of claim, evidence, reasoning. Where if you look at ELA and they're writing an essay, they have claim, evidence, warrant. That's what they use in our school. And, you know, if you look at creating explanations, I don't care what subject you teach, Students need to create explanations, right? They need to tell you, here's my answer. Here's why I got to this answer. And this is the piece of information that makes this answer relevant, right? And so we make sure that they have those three pieces. Give me your answer, what led you to it, and what makes it relevant. And like that can transfer to any class, right? And same thing with data analysis. If you're in history doing DBQs, like, you know, it's not quantitative, it's qualitative. Like, you know, so it doesn't really matter. There's so much overlap. Now, there are things that are unique, right? No other subject does labs. So experimental design, well, okay, that's unique to science. So there are going to be some things that are unique, but we decided we're going to go with transferable skills. And we call, you know, the science practices, right? And we took those and we kind of repackaged them into like chunks that made sense because they have like a graphing standard. And what we found was assessing graphing, both creation and interpretation, was tough because some people can interpret a graph really well, but can't create it, or they can create a graph, but really don't know what it means. And so we had to tease those apart. And those were, that's where it became tricky is like, you know, what are the things that go together? What are the things that are dependent on the others? And then we put those together. What are the things that like we thought went together, but like it was really hard to assess together? And then we teased them apart. And that's really where we refined over those next 3 years. So the first 3 years was really just finding like what content or like what we found important and how we were going to assess it. The next 3 years was really getting that language clear, teasing things apart and making it make sense to both us and students so that like, you know, it didn't matter. Like Elise could look at my stuff and we'd come up with the same score. Right. So go ahead. Yeah.
Oh, I was just still thinking about, you mentioned DBQs and how I'm having PTSD because of all the reading and grading of those when I did AP US history years ago. But the one thing that the AP program has, and I did not have a conversation with you ahead of time, but I understand your issues. I'm sure I've heard these issues because a lot of people probably had the same ones with College Board and the way the AP program operates and everything. But the one thing they did have going for it was that when it came to the standards, it wasn't a list of 100 different things that they need to know X, X, Y, you know, Z, blah, 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 blah. It was not only do you need to know this stuff, but you need to be able to apply it kind of things. And like the thing that was coming into my mind a little bit is I remember this sample DBQ that I had my students write on a few years ago that it didn't talk about the Civil War in this battle took place here on this date and this many Confederate and Union soldiers died. It was more about what was the economic impact of Sherman's march to the sea. In terms of like the railroads that were destroyed and the farms that were destroyed along the way and the people that were displaced as a result of Sherman's march and everything. And I just felt that had the standard was so much more robust as a result of that. And, you know, hearing you talk about, you know, you starting with 60 I can statements and then, you know, figuring out those most important ones. It's something very similar in my opinion.
Yeah. And so now we're down to 10.
Wow.
Yeah.
And Dave, I think you bring up a good point. So my district is, we're right now kind of in the first year of this work where we're looking at the standards and really drilling down. And previous job that I had was as we rolled out the standards, I trained teachers on it and it was always like, you have to teach all these. There's a reason that they are. And now we've kind of shifted our thinking to that idea. But I love the fact that you said, look, it's taken you guys a chunk of time to do this. And I think sometimes in education, we're like, we're going to do this right now. And next year, it's going to be perfect. And we really had to say, okay, we had a team of teachers go through and look at these are our essential standards. So like for my fourth grade, they've identified a group of teachers across our district. But I've really talked with my staff at least about like, hey, next year, we're going to have to tweak this. And next year after that, you're going to have to tweak it. So I think that's important. I think people really should pay attention to it. It sounds like this is a evolving process for you.
Yeah. And right now it's not, evolving as much as it did in the beginning.
Okay.
Right now we're at a point where we're very happy with the model, and it's just like fine tuning. Like that's where we're at right now. And the one thing that I'll say that we had going for us, it was just the two of us. So we didn't have that institutional inertia. You know, it wasn't, we didn't have to convince 10 other people that this is a good idea. We saw a problem and we're just like, oh, all right, let's try this. And the next day we tried that. Right. So when you have that team, that doesn't happen, you know? And yeah. So, you know, be mindful of that when you put your team together. Right.
Right. Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, yeah, two people is different than I'm in a district, clearly not as big as Kyle's district, but we've got, you know, 65,000 kids. I mean, we're talking, you know, like 10 high schools and then all the feeder schools and everything. So yeah, we have a huge district where we're doing this work at a district level. Yeah. And it's like, you know, getting, and you know this, I'm sure with your partner, I mean, I worked in a team, getting two people to agree on something sometimes, I mean, much less, we brought together teams of teachers and then presented it to more teachers. So I think it might have been easy in some ways, a lot easier just to do it with two people.
Oh yeah, absolutely. But like, you know, the one thing that you have to come up with is non-negotiables. And this is where admin is, if you're trying to scale right. this right. is where their role is saying, okay, here are the non-negotiables. Here are things that we must see, right? And not making it a top-down model, but like, because the teachers really need to have ownership of it, and they do need right. to shape it, because they're the ones who are dealing with the students, and right. you have to talk to them daily. You know, like I talk to every single one of my students every single day, mm-hmm. And I do formal surveys with them twice a year, and mm-hmm. we have informal conferencing, and so like I'm getting a ton of feedback from them,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And like, if I have to then wait to go to a meeting to present it to somebody to then go back and now let's brainstorm, what are we going to do about this? So I can go back to that student and say, okay, here's our solution. Like that's not going to work. Right. So you have to have some kind of autonomy where you can make those adjustments as you're going through it. You know, and so what we did is we tried to provide a flexible framework. So where I found we started with standards-based grading and we found that it was just like very rigid because it was still grading. So now that's the whole like gradeless model. It's not about points and scores, and we don't even show students what expert looks like on the rubric, right? So at the beginning of the year, if we're targeting developing, everything else is blacked out, right? They can't even see what that is. We don't want them looking beyond what they're practicing and ready to do, you know, where when you're looking at standards-based grading, it's a proficiency scale, right? Where do you fall in there?
That is an interesting concept, because I know a lot of people will talk about when I always think about like the model, like this is what you're, and I'm drawing a blank on the word, but I mean, like
exemplar.
Exemplar. Thank you. That, yes. So you would have an exemplar and the kids would be like, this is what I expect you to get. And I that is an interesting approach. Do you find, do you do that because kids will just gravitate straight to that last one?
Yeah, that's exactly why it started. But something interesting happened when we did it. The students who we historically say are behind were no longer behind. You know, and just that psychology for them of, well, I'm not playing catch up. I'm where I'm supposed to be, right? You know, we're only practicing developing. I'm developing. Great. You know, and we do still give exemplars, but the exemplar is at the developing level. And so this is what developing looks like. And they practice that. Now, the students who have that down and are ready to move on, as the teacher, I know what's next. So I coach them to those higher levels of sophistication, mm-hmm. but until the class is ready to move on, we don't open it up. So this way, nobody is trying to do something they're not ready for, but the people who are ready to do it, you know, it doesn't change the way we approach anything. It's just like, okay, great. You know, so in this response, you defined all of these terms. You know, next time, if you could just say like how it applies, you know, and just kind of connect them and, or whatever it is, like, you know, or, with problem solving. You know, I see relevant work. You showed me the equation you use. Next time, if you could just like draw and label your sketch so you can show me where all these variables are occurring, that would make that work even better. You know, and so it doesn't matter where a student is in that progression. Like I say, okay, here's the one or two things that you need to do to get to that next level, whatever it is. If you're at the beginning level, it's one or two things to get to developing. If you're at developing, it's proficient and so on. So it really helps differentiation because we're no longer differentiating opportunity. And like Kyle, like as a special education teacher, right? You look at courses that are sometimes vastly different than, you know, so I was teaching, we call the course conceptual physics. And it was more like a survey course. Now I give students AP worksheets, you know? And so they're looking at it, they're like, you gave me the wrong sheet. I was like, no, I didn't. It doesn't matter. Physics is physics. We're just looking for different things, right? I don't expect them to be able to, on their own, do a multi-step problem. So maybe we take that multi-step problem and say, hey, just draw it, right? And then after they draw it, say, okay, we're going to do just part A. We're going to look for this. So find this. And then, you know, so it really doesn't matter. So, and like the pride that you see on their face when they're saying, wait a second, I'm not doing different work. I'm doing the same work that, you know, not just kids in my class, but other levels. Like when I took over conceptual physics, they're like, we're the dumb class. Like, don't you know, we can't do this stuff. And like that bothered me. And so like now with this approach, it's just like, no, you're doing physics. It's, you know, we go a little slower and, you know, I give you a couple of hints, but it's physics, you know?
Yeah. My experience right now is similar to that with algebra, where the team of algebra teachers, they're not all doing the co-taught classes like I work with. They're doing, I don't want to say advanced because it's not honors algebra or anything, but similar concept that my kids are doing the same work that those other classes are doing because they're planning it together. And they're saying that this is the common assessment for everybody. And this is the day that we're hoping to give that assessment. So we have to figure out our own ways to get to there. And with my co-teacher and I, we figured it out. And I feel like we're doing very well with that. So now kind of shifting gears a little bit, I do want to talk about the book a little bit more, kind of like where the idea for the book came from. And then like you've mentioned Elise, your co-author, with that a few times, like where did this idea come from with the two of you? And then like, what was your process with the book?
So like I said, it was frustration. Grades kind of got in the way of everything. And like the title Going Gradeless, I know a lot of people look at it and some people find it controversial, but it's really about like good pedagogy and just like approaching students from a place of strength instead of deficits, you know, communication, collaboration, and grading just happened to be the last thing that was getting in the way. And I really didn't see a lot of success until I threw that away. And so that's kind of where Going Gradeless came from. And Elise and I have shared a room since I started teaching at Pascack Hills 10 years ago. And so, you know, we always collaborated. We were at teaching different courses. We had a couple of courses that overlap, but we always collaborated. And then, you know, she saw what I was doing. She saw the benefit to my students and she's like, I want to try that too. Cause she was seeing, you know, some of the same challenges in her students. And you know, we did different things. We kept notes. We never intended to publish a book. But like the science teachers in us, like we just took a lot of data, you know? And, so I had like 6 years worth of data. And, at the end of it, I was just like, wow, you know, this stuff's pretty powerful. I got to share it. You know, it's not, it was never a goal of mine. And then I said to her, I was just like, you know what? You want to publish this? I have like, I write for me, like just to kind of like clear my head. And so like I had probably about half the book already done just in notes to myself. And so I just started like kind of consolidating it and putting it together. And I passed it off to her. I was like, what do you think? And so that was kind of our process. And, you know, when COVID hit, I had some time.
Yeah.
And,
we all did.
Yeah. You know, so, we were all remote. I was working from home. We're all in the house. And my buddy, AJ Bianco, he's just like, dude, you should like try Corwin, like, you know, see if they want it. And so I wrote a 7-page prospectus, sent it over to him, and, you know, they were great. Like they kind of took it from there. Like once they accepted the manuscript, their team was like, so amazing. I don't think the book would be anywhere near as good as it is if they weren't involved. Mm-hmm. You know, cause like from the copy editing to the peer review to, image editors and like, you know, just every step of the way, like, you know, they gave us hints. We went back and forth. And, so the whole process took about a year from the time I contacted Corwin till it got published. But like most of the book was written before that. So we got our contract. I contacted them in March. I went back and forth, and obviously everybody was short staffed. So it took a while to actually get to the contract. So I think we signed the contract in July. Our first draft was due 6 weeks later. So we got the draft in. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And like, it was something that was agreed upon because like, you know, they knew how far along we were.
Right.
And so they sent it out to peer review. We got it back. We had another 6 weeks and then, just did the copy editing. I think we were all done probably by the new year, like, 21. Yeah, you know, so end of December, beginning of January, mm-hmm. 21, we had finished it up, and it was published in March. You know,
so did you have so since the book's been published, and do you have like have districts, have schools reached out to you?
Yeah, you know what, like the support we've got has been amazing, and you know, the podcast network, like you guys, and you know, Podcast PD, Teachers on Fire, you know, like. Everybody, they've been amazing having me on, and like kind of spreading the word. We have 3 college courses that use this as required reading.
Nice.
Yeah. So we have, a couple of districts that have done book studies on it. Teach Better team did a book study on it and, which was awesome. You know, I'm talking to the Ottawa Catholic School Board in February. They're doing a book study on it now. So it's gaining some steam. And I mean, it's kind of surreal that like, you know, I mean, I'm a teacher from New Jersey who was just trying to do right by my kids. And like, you know, now I got like, I think last I checked, it's like almost like 40 different countries and, you know, like 45 states that have like looked at my work, which is nuts.
So where can people find you on social media, connect with you, connect with the book, get a copy of the book, things of that nature?
Yeah. So me, I made it real hard to find me. It's at David Frangiosa on Twitter, you know? So I do have a blog and the podcast. You can find that at reimagineschools.com. The book is on Amazon or you can go to Corwin. Yeah. And that's it. Like Twitter is really my only social media. I don't do the others. I have a hard enough time. I got 2 little kids, like keeping up with Twitter's enough.
Well, yeah. And people definitely should go like hit you up on Twitter. Cause I know on your bio, it has a link to your other stuff. So definitely go there.
Well, David, it's been great talking to you for almost an hour here. I looked at the time. Holy cow. I can't believe how fast that went by. Cause that was absolutely great. Everything you share. We can't thank you enough.
Well, thanks for having me on.
No, I think this is super timely. It is. I mean, I'm super fascinated in this because it is something that in my district, I was very lucky as a when I was in the classroom, I was lucky to work at two schools that did standards-based grading. And I think that was a step, it sounds like, in your journey. And I hopefully, you know, more people out there are really rethinking how we're doing something that we've, just because we've been doing it for 100-something years, doesn't mean it's the right thing to be doing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, thank you so much for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys.
Absolutely. Well, stick around because we still have a little bit more. But first, let's keep this conversation going and share some of your thoughts on today's topics. You can do that by emailing us at info@beeredupodcast.com. You can tweet us at @beeredupod and then #beeredupod. Hit us up on Facebook at @beeredupodcast. It's all one word. On Instagram at @beeredupod. That's more of the fun one where we're sharing beers out on that one. You can subscribe to our YouTube channel at bit.ly/beeredu YouTube and get notified when we're going to record these live. And again, make sure you're following David at David Frangiosa on Twitter. You can do a voice message on the Anchor app, and then we'll feature that in the show. And please leave us a review wherever you are listening so more can find the podcast. And Ben, if others want to be on the show, what must one do to get on?
Yeah, so you just need to go to our website, beeredupodcast.com. You click on the link that will send you to our contact and subscription info. You can complete the guest form, you get in the queue, and we just would love to have you on to talk about what you're passionate about in education. And we would be remiss if we didn't thank some people for putting the Beer EDU podcast out there. You know, check out School Rubric. They feature our podcast on there. Their mission is to help schools, educators, and parents and students tell their stories so that all stakeholders can make the best choices about enrollment and staffing. So check out schoolrubric.com and find out more great content from educators all over. And then we're also very lucky to be part of the Codebreaker podcast network. So check out other amazing podcasts like Staff Room Podcast, STEM Every Day, Teachers on Fire, EdTech Life. So go to codebreakers.com. So Dave, this is the part you've listened to the show where Kyle has a learn about, and I'm totally going to own that I haven't even looked at the show notes that far down the list. So I don't even know what we're learning about.
All right. So surprise, because the other days you look at them and you're like, I don't know what this is, Kyle. So
I probably don't know what it is. So we'll see.
Well, I didn't know much about it either before I did this. So today we're going to look at what is a kettle sour. So maybe this is something that you have heard of before.
I don't know anything about it.
All right. Anymore, I feel like if you go to a brewery and they don't have a sour on tap, it's strange because.
Do you think the sour is the new IPA? I'm just saying.
I honestly kind of do because to me, a sour beer is a lot more accessible to non-beer drinkers than an IPA is. So yes. I think it's definitely something that has become the new IPA. But now when it comes to sour beers,
if you're a brewer.
Absolutely. And then, you know, a lot of brewers are starting to do the seltzers now too, which I think we need to do a learn about the hard seltzer because that's kind of a thing now too. So, but now sour beers fall into two categories. So you got your traditional sours. These are ones that rely on wild yeast and bacteria for fermentation. And a lot of times they age them in wooden barrels. So these are ones like a lot of your traditional Belgian beers are like this. Kettle sours, or you'll sometimes hear these known as quick sours. They take a lot less time. They're fermented in a stainless steel kettle or a fermenter. And then rather than relying on wild yeast and bacteria, they pitch lactobacillus to quicken that process up along with the standard yeast. So another difference is whether oxygen is allowed to be part of that process. Now with a traditional sour, these are usually done in an open air vessel where the natural yeast and the bacteria in the air with oxygen combine with the wort. Kettle sours are always in a sealed vessel for the most part. They minimize the amount of oxygen that gets in there. It prevents outside yeast and bacteria from getting into the brew as well. Now, when it comes to the difference, it can come down to looks and taste. Your traditional sours, those can vary from batch to batch because if you're relying on what's in the air, there might be a lot of yeast in the air the one time that you're pitching it.
Right.
And then the next time later in the year, maybe you don't have as much yeast in the air. So the weather could actually have something to do with it. Right. So now kettle sours, though, they're a lot more close in consistency because a lot of those variables are limited or even just outright eliminated. So like when you got this sealed vessel that you're keeping outside yeast from getting in, you're not going to get a lot of differences. So your difference then is if you don't clean your lines or clean your equipment real well. So if you brew beer at all, you know how important that is.
Yeah.
So now when it comes to styles that fall in each of these categories, so your traditional sours, your lambics, which very low ABV, very tasty. Love those. Yep. The Gueuses, which is a form of a lambic where they take the ones that are about a year old, combine it with a new one, and then age them together. Mm-hmm. So they're kicked up a little bit more. I know I've had a Flanders red ale before, but I don't even really know what it is. It's a sour beer that I think has a little bit more hops in it. So I'm going to have to do some digging on that one too. Because that's one I know I've had those before. So those are more your traditional ones. Your kettle ones, this is really a United States kind of thing, a North America kind of thing. But so a lot of the sours that your brewers are doing now, those are all going to be kettle sours, unless they specifically say like wild ale. Your Berliner Weiss style, your Goza styles, those German ones, those typically are kettle sours as well because they can be produced a lot more quickly. So, but yeah, so that was just a quick little rundown on the kettle sour.
Yeah, I'm looking like right now on Untappd, and I'm like, I feel like the sour is like a thing now where like when you go to a brewery, they will have a sour. I mean, they'll always have an IPA. A good brewery is going to maybe have a double and stuff, but they're going to have, I feel like a sour is going to be on their list.
Yeah, I will say that my new favorite brewery here in Las Vegas, Mojave Brewing, which actually it's in Henderson, not Las Vegas. They only usually have one or two IPAs on tap. And then they have a couple sours, and then they also do their own ciders there. So different fruit ciders that are on the list. But they are also real good about doing a lot of brews that are just not typical of the brewery around the world. Like they have a good brown ale every now and then. And then they had an English bitter for a while that was on cask, and it was incredible. I talked about that on the show. And right now they have an 18% imperial stout that is not barrel aged. It is straight up just barley. Is how they did an 18%er. And I can't say the name of it on here because that would give us an explicit rating for what they named this beer. Man. But it is definitely something that you don't mess with. That gives you a clue as to what they named it.
Yeah, I know, because now I'm looking on my Untappd and I'm like, I've had a lot of sours. Apparently,
they're good. I have a friend that's all he drinks. I don't know how he doesn't have an ulcer ripped into his body because they can get a little acidic for me. So they are, like them, but I can't drink a lot of them.
If my wife and I, when we go out and she's not a big beer drinker, and we've talked about that, she likes a Saison and she will get a sour. Yeah. But that's like, those are her, that's in her, or a Hef. That's Hefeweizen is her. Yeah. She will never drink an IPA. I always make her try mine. And she's like, is the word. Yeah. She's not a fan.
That sound, my wife's the same way. So. Now, David, how do you feel about the sours? Yeah, are you on the sour bandwagon?
Not really. So, I am more like the IPA, and so that's just, I don't know.
I'm with you, man. Yeah, there has to be a specific time that I will drink a sour. And Kyle and I have talked about this. Like, I'm a big one for food, beer and food. Like, so if we're at a restaurant, there's certain things that I will order, certain beers with, certain food. Like if we're going to Mexican food, like classic, a lager, perfect. IPA, not so much. But, you're going with wings, IPA. So, I don't know. It's an acquired
taste. A good stout with a steak. That's me.
There it is. Yeah.
See, I like to drink before, after, not during my meal, though.
I'm kind of the same way. Don't like Ben loves his IPAs with chicken wings. I don't drink beer with wings at all, hardly. So it's an afterward kind of deal for me. So
I will don't, but see, I don't like a stout with food. I will do a stout with dessert. That's just, I don't know. That's like a more coffee style. So each his own. I mean, we've discussed this. There's no bad beer and there's no bad pizza. There's just grades. There's just grades.
So
right on, man. So, hey, Dave, thank you for being on. This is, I think, Kyle, this is it. This wraps up episode 118. Dave, again, it was great having you on. Awesome topic.
Thanks again for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. And listeners, as always, thank you. And until next time, may the malts and the hops be with you.
Right on.